Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We've spent, what, a couple of trillion dollars on various bailout programs? The promise being that at the very least, all that money would make the financial system safer. Sometimes, I guess, things don't turn out the way you want, do they? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by SunGard. SunGard Availability Services operates 5 million square feet of secure data center space dedicated to keeping people and information connected. More information at sunguard.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, today the 21st of October, and it is great to have you here. First things first, about all that bailout money, the TARP Inspector General Neil Barofsky released a report today saying the odds of taxpayers getting all of it back are slim. Not really a surprise. More interesting, though, is what Barofsky had to say about what government intervention has done to the financial industry's long-term sustainability. Here he is on CNBC this morning.
Because of the moral hazard, because of some of the systemic risks that are associated with making these institutions bigger and bigger, trimming their competition, and giving them the opportunity to take more and more risk, systemically, we may be in a more dangerous place even than when we were a year ago.
Marketplace's Steve Henn picks up the story for us.
Barofsky's not the only one who's worried about this.
The too-important-to-fail problem is too-important to ignore.
Mervyn King is the governor of the Bank of England. He says the global banking bailout
has created possibly the biggest moral hazard in history.
Banks that were too big to fail couldn't go bankrupt, so executives were free to take wild risks. The bailout made the largest banks even bigger by forcing mergers. So King and former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker are now calling for banks' breakup. Economist Simon Johnson agrees.
What you need is to make these bigger banks, the biggest banks, small enough so you can handle the management of each one of them individually, or even if they fail in something of a group, that doesn't destabilize the entire economy.
But can you imagine Congress breaking up Goldman Sachs? Not likely. And many believe it would be impractical. Hal Scott teaches bank regulation at Harvard Law School.
So if we break up our banks and Europe doesn't break up theirs and the Chinese don't break up theirs, this is going to have an immense impact on, you know, who are the players in the international banking system.
So Scott backs the administration's idea of giving regulators the power to dismantle huge failing institutions. Bank investors would still take the losses, even if the government propped up a bank to save the larger economy. But doubters think bank executives, still seeking millions, will take huge new risks down the road. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Quote of the day on this Wednesday goes to Bank of England Governor Mervyn King. You heard part of a speech he gave up at the top of Steve's story. Elsewhere in those remarks, King channeled his inner Winston Churchill and came up with this gem about banks and all the government support they've gotten. Never before, King said, has so much money been owed by so few to so many. I thought that was pretty good. There is no telling how much the swine flu could end up costing in lost lives and lost productivity and medical expenses. The vaccine is only now making its way to hospitals and doctors' offices across the country. But the estimates for those costs are in the multi-billions of dollars. And hospitals are especially worried, not just about their ability to care for all the people who get sick, but about being able to carry on their other business as usual. Joel Rose explains.
It's hard to say how the swine flu pandemic will affect hospitals' bottom lines, because no one knows how many people will get sick enough to be admitted.
If this became a severe outbreak, then we would expect that the financial effect on hospitals would be significant.
Eric Toner is a researcher at the Center for Biosecurity at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. Toner and his colleagues predicted that a severe flu pandemic could cost hospitals as much as $3.9 billion. That's in part because hospitals would see more uninsured patients. And there are only so many hospital beds. If lots of swine flu patients need those beds, Toner says hospitals would be forced to delay other procedures that aren't as critical, but much more lucrative.
Hospitals stay profitable to the extent that they are profitable by high-profit services such as elective surgeries. So if hospitals have to defer elective surgeries, that will definitely impact them adversely.
Toner says that's not a problem now because the pandemic is still mild. But it wouldn't take much to disrupt business as usual at many hospitals, says Boston University public health professor David Ozenoff.
They have MRI suites and colonoscopy suites that are doing procedures one right after another throughout the day, and some of them run 24/7. If you have to start rescheduling that, that's going to cut into their income.
Ozenoff agrees that hospitals have been able to cope with the swine flu outbreak so far, but he also warns that anything you predict about flu is bound to be wrong. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, there was a little something going around. Traders gave up the chase about an hour before the closing bell. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was big news on the healthcare debate today out of an unlikely source. The House Judiciary Committee has voted to strip health insurance companies of their antitrust exemptions. That is, their ability to get together and fix prices and allocate the market. It's a luxury the industry has enjoyed since the end of the Second World War. There is a plan to do the same thing, strip that exemption, in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And as commentator Robert Reich is about to explain, the president has been talking about it too, because health insurance is the latest skirmish in the healthcare fight.
Suddenly, it seems, the White House is blasting away at private insurers. Why? Because the insurers broke the deal the White House thought they'd agreed to last January. That deal was simple. Private insurers would support new health care legislation, even requiring they take people with pre-existing conditions, because the insurers would get 25 to 30 million new paying customers and the profits that go with all these new customers. But in recent weeks, private insurers have done an about-face. They've been running ads questioning the emerging legislation. They've even released a study claiming that a Senate version of health care reform would cost middle-class consumers a bundle. The easiest explanation for the insurers' about-face is Congress's growing reluctance to require that all Americans buy insurance and penalize them if they don't, especially young, healthy adults. The insurers are right to worry. If the young and healthy don't buy in, the insurers' costs are going to rise. That's because, with no limit on pre-existing conditions, a larger proportion of the insured will be older and sicker. But if the insurers were in tough competition with each other, they'd have every incentive to find ways to keep prices down, even though the population they serve may be older and sicker. They'd use new technologies, minimize unnecessary tests, pay physicians and hospitals for outcomes rather than inputs, and help prevent healthy people from becoming sick. But the truth is, they don't compete intensely in most markets, and they'd rather not, which is why their abrupt about-face on the deal they struck with the White House opens insurers to the biggest threat of all. As the president said a few days ago, removal of the exemption the industry has under federal antitrust laws. The president could have gone a step further and committed himself to a public insurance option. That would guarantee more competition and give the private insurers a better run for their money and their profits.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Take a second to share your thoughts with us. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says what? Oh, yeah, contact. We started the broadcast yesterday with a report on corporate profits, how a lot of companies have been doing better than expected, some of them even while their earnings have actually fallen. It is no fun at all digesting those earnings announcements, but there are always interesting things to learn about how Wall Street really works. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon is here to tell us what's what. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Kai.
Where do we stand on the scorecard of better than or not better than expected?
Well, so far, about three-quarters of the companies reporting their earnings have beat expectations. Now, some skeptics are saying that that might just mean that the prognosticators are setting that bar too low.
Where does the bar come from, though? I mean, what is this expectations thing?
Well, some of those expectations are based on the guidance that the companies themselves have provided. Now, the cynics will tell you there that those companies can try to lower expectations so then they can beat the number. Well, that's where the analysts come in. It's their job to determine if those management expectations are too low or too optimistic. And then the market watchers put those numbers together and they arrive at a consensus estimate, an actual number that predicts where those earnings should actually fall.
And that number is expressed usually in earnings per share.
That's correct.
And then what happens is the company either beats it or doesn't. The share goes up or down, and we're off and running in the stock market.
That's right. Well, Apple did that. It just soared tremendously because of their performance. If you're an investor trying to play the market, you might think that that's pretty straightforward, and you can take a look at that consensus estimate and make your own judgment, and then maybe ride the stock up or down. But, you know, it's risky to make assumptions about the stock market.
Yeah, it kind of sounds here, Bob, like you're going to tell me I don't know something that I don't know.
Well, it sounds to me like maybe you had a hunch, though. You know, I learned a lot about the way Wall Street operates from what I learned in high school.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Well, let me take you back to when I was a wee lad of 15. We had this candy drive at our school. Bear with me here. I'll try to make this short and sweet.
That's fine.
Okay. We were selling chocolate bars for a fundraiser, and I was in a dead heat with a classmate for the grand prize, a shiny new TV. So heading into the final weekend, I was very careful to guarantee that at the very least I was going to tie her. I took out as much candy as she did. And I made sure to sell every last bar. And then when I came in Monday morning, I was shocked to discover that she'd aced me out of the grand prize.
How'd she do it, Bob?
Well, this was really traumatic. It was heartbreaking for me. Sometime during the weekend, she called up a teacher and she got more candy to sell. And I had naively assumed that that was against the rules, right? And that pretty much parallels the way you can get burned if you're trying to make assumptions about Wall Street. Just when you thought you got it figured out, they go and they change the rules on you or what you thought were the rules. That may be what we saw happen with Goldman Sachs.
But Goldman, if I remember, actually beat expectations.
That's right. And if you were an investor expecting to ride that stock up on those expectations, you were in for a big surprise because the stock actually tanked that day. And if you were expecting a resulting rally in financials, that never materialized.
So what happened?
Well, we think that what happened was the whisper number came into play.
All right, the what?
The whisper number. This is something that actually is known on Wall Street. Psst, this is something that's too late to maybe make it into a published analyst report. So it spreads around among people in the know.
Huh.
This number that you think it's going to change the actual analyst projections. And in Goldman's case, the consensus estimate was earnings of $4 a share. They came in around $5 a share, but the whisper number we hear was around $6 a share. And so they disappointed.
Yeah, but they're not whispering to the average investor. Are they allowed to do this?
It's not insider trading. Remember, Wall Street trades on rumor all the time. Buy on the rumors, sell on the news.
And what you don't know about Wall Street can hurt you. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Scott.
And now, let's do the numbers. Alas, 10,000, we hardly knew you. The Dow Industrials fell back 0.9% today, 92 points, closed at 99.49. The NASDAQ clipped off 0.5%, 12 points, finished at 21.50. The S&P 500 forfeited 0.8%, that is 9 points, closed at 1,081. Financial firms headed downhill on fears of more bank losses. Wells Fargo set off the slide after an analyst advised selling that stock. Its shares dropped more than 5%. J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America both withdrew about 3%. Morgan Stanley could not be contained. It gained nearly 5% today, reporting better-than-expected quarterly profits. There's that phrase again. Big quarterly losses grounded Boeing. Stock shares dove more than 2.33%. Walmart also hit the mats. Its stock fell more than 2% today on news the giant retailer will slash holiday prices. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.39%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals at Vanguard.com. and by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. ProduceMoreConserveMore.com. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee holds a hearing on the outlook for America's economy. A House Committee on Livestock, Dairy, and Poultry reviews the economic conditions facing the pork industry. And take a walk on the boardwalk in Vegas, baby. The Monopoly World Championship concludes. Someone will get a trophy and $20,580. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. 47 million people in this country live in poverty. That's about 7 million more than the official government estimate. The revision comes courtesy of a new formula that the Census Bureau has been playing with. The government has been measuring poverty for 40 or more years, yet the basic methodology hasn't really changed much in all that time. Sheldon Danziger is a professor of public policy at the University of Michigan. Professor, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
How do we measure poverty right now, and what would a new set of numbers change?
Right now, we have a poverty line based on food. The new poverty line would be based on food, clothing, and shelter utilities. The current poverty line goes up only with inflation. The new poverty line would go up with how the typical household spends on these necessities. On the income side, additional benefits would be counted. The two biggest ones today are the food stamp program and the earned income tax credit, which millions of low-income families get in the form of a tax rebate. So there would be people going from below to above and above to below. What the Census Bureau is saying is that if they had been using this line for the last 9 or 10 years, by 2008, the poverty rate would have risen more under the new measure than it did under the official measure.
Wow, because we have changed the way we spend so much.
The new measure is reflecting this spending on a broader basket of goods. Many of these could not have been foreseen when the official poverty line was being developed. It was a good line for its era, but in a day when there's so many more working families, child care expenses have gone up, out-of-pocket medical costs obviously are much higher these days than they were. And so in part, it's 45 years since this important indicator has been redefined.
There are a couple of bills proposing to change the way we measure poverty floating around Congress. What might these numbers do to their chances for political survival, and what might that mean?
I would think that the chances of our getting a change in the measure are better now than they've been in a long time. There's some controversial issues that I haven't mentioned. For example, geographic differences. The representatives from areas with high housing costs think the idea of adjusting for cost of living is a good idea. It's often the case that the representatives and senators from areas where the housing costs are low don't think it's such a good idea. So there are some issues which I think are perceived as political. But given the current administration, as I understand it, candidate Obama had endorsed the Measuring American Poverty Act while he was campaigning. So I would think if the act passes the Congress, then the president would certainly sign it.
Sheldon Danziger, he's a professor of public policy at the University of Michigan. Thanks so much for your time.
Sure. Good talking to you.
It's all earnings all the time this week. Microsoft joins the party Friday with its quarterly profit report, bound to make news, as it always does. But tomorrow could actually be a bigger deal for the company. Windows 7, that's Microsoft's new operating system, hits the shelves and millions of PCs after years of development and testing, and also after some contrite and questionable public relations work. John Moe reports.
Hey, welcome to the party. The four of us, along with Host Worldwide and you, are launching Windows 7 Ultimate Software. So, you know what? Let's take a minute or so to tell you about how great it is to host a launch party.
Have you seen this video online? It's already a YouTube classic because the unintentional comedy value is off the charts. Bad actors tell you how fun it is to host a launch party for Windows 7. Yep, Microsoft wants you to host a party for a computer operating system.
Can you believe that Microsoft put the launch of Windows 7 in our hands? Are they nuts or what?
Not nuts, bad actor, just a little shaken up. See, Microsoft used to have swagger. It put out a new operating system and pretty much everyone would buy it. That is, until Vista. Vista was slow and overloaded with security prompts. It didn't work with some hardware. It was a mess. Microsoft's whole marketing campaign for Windows 7 is built around apologizing for Vista. George Byrne manages Chipheads, a computer repair shop in St. Paul. He's been wrestling with Vista since it was released in January of 07.
We get a lot of people who come in and say they don't like Vista or they don't want it on a new machine. You know, they tell their friends and say, you know, Vista's horrible, I have so many problems with it.
In fact, only about 20% of PCs ever ended up running Vista. That lack of adoption is critical, according to Brendan Barnicle, an analyst at Pacific Crest Securities.
Vista represented the first time that people didn't make that move from the prior release to the current release. And if that were to become a practice, that'd be very damaging to the Microsoft model long term.
Even the short-term damage was pretty rough. Microsoft's third-quarter earnings fell 17% from 2008. The economy didn't help, but neither did Vista. Rivals capitalized.
Hello, I'm American.
My fellow Americans, I'm a PC.
Why so official?
Well, some people are giving up on Vista Mac because it doesn't work the way they want it to.
Once again, analyst Brendan Barnicle.
I don't think it's a coincidence that Apple's market share increased at exactly the time that Vista came out. I think their product was getting better, but I think more importantly, Vista was so weak that it opened up the option for an alternative.
Microsoft still dominates the market with a 93% share. And again, 80% of PCs have not upgraded since Windows XP. It came out 8 years ago. Global PC sales are expected to improve with the economy, and Windows 7 is getting good reviews. Add in that Microsoft's Bing search engine seems to be catching on, and things in Redmond may be looking up.
The success that they are likely to have with 7, and coincidentally the success we've seen with Bing, has really renewed the confidence of the rank-and-file developers at Microsoft to demonstrate that they really can build industry-leading products again.
So those launch parties might be a little more fun.
Make the thing you're demonstrating personal to someone at the party, like the way I made chips files get transferred by Windows Easy Transfer.
Or the way I showed my guest web slices by talking about Frank's online auction shop.
Okay, only a little more fun. In St. Paul, I'm John Moe for Marketplace.
Cadbury, the British chocolate maker, announced third-quarter sales this morning, up 7%. That is good news for them. Not so good, though, for Kraft. Cadbury turned down a $16 billion bid from the American food company last month, saying it's worth more than that. Cadbury is also suggesting it's just too cool for a big old conglomerate like Kraft. From London, Christopher Worth reports now on the company's lighter side.
Obviously, in this demonstration area, we deal with a lot of handmade chocolates.
At Cadbury's headquarters, just outside Birmingham, a group of visitors are taking a tour of Cadbury World. It's a place where kids can get a first-hand look at how chocolate is made, and their parents can watch old Cadbury commercials they haven't seen for decades. You might remember this one from the 1980s. It features a rabbit that clucks like a chicken and lays Cadbury cream eggs.
You're looking at a very unusual kind of egg from Cadbury.
This factory churns out about 1.5 million cream eggs a day, many of them headed for America's candy aisles. Cadbury's been in the chocolate business for almost two centuries. But earlier this decade, the company's image had fallen behind the times.
I would imagine a couple of years ago, my perception of Cadbury might have been slightly old and fusty,
very traditional product.
Ben Walker is with the advertising agency Wieden & Kennedy. He says that image changed almost overnight in 2007 when Cadbury launched this ad of a gorilla quietly sitting behind a drum set listening to Phil Collins.
I remember the first time I saw gorilla, it's like, it still makes me smile now, you know.
The gorilla closes its eyes, takes a deep breath, and then starts pounding on the drums. For just a brief moment at the end, a candy bar appears on the screen. Walker says he did something he almost never does while watching a commercial. He pressed pause.
Yeah, stopped it. It was absolutely bizarre. I sat there looking a little bit puzzled and loving what I was seeing. And then sort of with my copywriter's brain on, I started going, well, hold on a minute, is that a good advert?
The ad strays pretty far from your typical commercial in that it doesn't offer any information about the actual product it's trying to sell. So does something like a drumming gorilla convince people to buy more chocolate? Tony Billsborough is a spokesman for Cadbury.
We saw sales rise by more than 10%. It's a phenomenal amount.
Ad man Ben Walker says the commercial also changed advertising by opening companies up to more exciting ideas. He said on a jury that voted it one of the best ads of the year. From then on, the question in corporate boardrooms has been,
what's the next gorilla? We want the next one of those, yeah.
Cadbury followed up with two more ads, including this commercial. It shows a drag race between all of those weird-looking trucks you see at the airport, the portable staircase, the conveyor belt truck, and the baggage trolley stuffed with suitcases, all of them racing down an empty runway at night. None of the ads have run in the U.S., but Cadbury's Tony Billsborough says they've received millions of hits on YouTube and inspired dozens of homemade spoofs from all over the world.
The advertising itself has actually made Cadbury, the brand, cool again.
And cool is something Kraft will probably have to pay extra for. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Those Cadbury ads, you've just got to see them to believe them. You can do that on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note this Wednesday afternoon, top earners at companies that got the most bailout help from the government are in for a huge pay cut. There are reports today that Kenneth Feinberg, the White House pay czar, is going to trim salaries an average of 90%. The details go like this. The cuts would be to the cash payouts for the top 25 paychecks at seven firms, Citigroup, Bank of America, AIG, and the car makers General Motors and Chrysler and their financing outfits as well. Special perks, stuff like country club memberships, that will be by government permission only. Not on the list for cuts is anybody who's paid back their bailout money already. You can look for the official announcement on that one in the next couple of days. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 92 points, 0.9%. The NASDAQ lost 12 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 fell 9 points, 0.8%. Thanks today to Jennifer Collins on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this broadcast, reflecting on life after Wall Street.
You know, if you do get let go, you know, ask yourself, was this really the right job for me anyway? Maybe there was something else that I would have rather done.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.